It's Wednesday, September 2nd, 2009, and you're listening to episode 161 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 3 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad, and I think this is fantastic.
Yay, welcome back.
Thank you.
My name's Wayne.
And my name is Pat.
Hi, Pat.
Hi, Chad.
Hi, Wayne. Wayne's back. Why is Wayne back?
Hold on. Does Chris not get to introduce himself?
He did.
I just jumped in and said some things to Chad, but my name is Chris.
Chad's not really here. That's really just Pat and Chris again.
That's true. We're pretty good at that now. Chad can even talk while I'm drinking a glass of water.
So, Dan, why is Wayne here?
Wayne is here because with John being away off at law school and such, and then on top of that, it'd just be nice for any of us to be able to not show up for a week without having to cancel the recording, we have brought Wayne on as a new full-time host.
Yay!
Full-time benefits. Did you sign your W-4 yet?
Not yet, but also I'm kind of like a virus, kind of like that thing Chad couldn't kick last week. It's hard to get rid of me.
Mm-hmm. I will pay you twice what we're paying Chad.
Excellent. I mean, no.
So anyway, welcome Wayne to the Fear the Boot family. And if he says anything that pisses you off, you can email him now at wayne@feartheboot.com.
Hold on. I'm getting my phone. Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E.
Let's just straighten to gaming stuff. I got a question for you guys. I actually posed
Man,
this.
I even had a banter topic that wasn't gaming related.
Oh, go ahead then.
Are you sure?
Yeah,
Are you sure
ahead.
You just want to jump into gaming
No,
stuff?
That's fine. We can come back to this.
Go no, ahead. we want to hear you talk.
I know.
It's such a rare thing for Chad to speak up during an episode. Yeah, we need
really.
To jump on this while we can.
I think it's a fantastic thing. So
That's so yesterday, last week,
mm-hmm.
something.
That's right. It's all played out.
Yeah.
You talked in the last episode, Pat. What was up with that?
I don't know.
That is crazy.
Maybe I didn't have somebody cutting me off all the time.
Yeah, anyway, shut up. So, we were talking at work, actually, kind of brought up, like, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word?
Mm-hmm. I have a favorite word. I've had a favorite word for a very long time.
Okay.
My favorite word is millennium.
Is there a particular reason? It's just fun to say.
I was asked why I like the word millennium today, and I had some reasons. I like how it rolls off the tongue. I like how you say it in the front of your mouth. And it's like millennium. It's kind of a manly word. It's got a lot of eyes and stuff.
If it's a manly word, I don't know that it fits for you to be using it.
But
Yeah.
Because I'm a woman, obviously. I have a vagina. So
you have a mangina. Let's get it right.
You remind me of a very sexy Sinead O'Connor.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's hideous.
Yeah.
So, like I said, it's kind of got a manly tone to it. It even means something cool, 1,000 years.
Mine is moron. And that's I'm not trying to be funny and direct that back at you. Though you can take it that way if you want to. So if you already have, go ahead and take it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's partially childhood memory because if anyone is as old as I am, but not as old as Chris, you probably grew up with a Saturday morning cartoon series. There was a Pac-Man cartoon, and on some weeks it would alternate to be a Q-Bert cartoon.
I remember that.
And in the Pac-Man cartoon, they had created a character that occurs nowhere in the video game, because of course you have to create some kind of a narrative. Yeah. There is no narrative to a yellow thing eating dots. It's a glutton. It's a fat ass. It's a...
But he,
diabetic in denial.
He had a whole family.
That came later. His wife and his bastard child came later. But there was a guy whose name I can't remember. I can picture him. He wore like this red robe that had this really high collar. He had kind of a big, tall egg head who was the guy that was in charge of the ghost monsters.
Hmm.
And every time they messed up, he would start calling them morons. And as a little kid, I and my sisters just found something hysterical about that word. I have no idea why, but we just found that word extremely funny. So to this day, it is still my favorite word.
Hmm.
My word would be rutabaga.
Rutabaga.
That's right.
It's kind of a neat word, though.
Story behind that is somebody once asked me to use the word rutabaga in a sentence some way every day. So for a year and a half, I found a way to work the word rutabaga into a sentence. Had to be a different way each day. But it continued for year and a half.
You couldn't just say the word rutabaga. Nope. It had to be like in
Is this like the Super Troopers meow pullover?
Kind of similar. We would work it into, I'd work it into meetings. Be like, can I get a status report on that rutabaga project? Or, you know what that needs? That needs a little more rutabaga.
Should I ask your question? I'll try to link this in the show notes. I've never seen Super Troopers either, but someone just sent me a link to it where apparently two of the cops make a bet and a guy in a pullover for a traffic stop has to say meow 10 times. And so it's just something like, you know, stop laughing at me. Meow then. And it's... I don't know. It's much fun.
I've heard of that. I've never seen it either, but I've heard of that scene. And yeah,
I have seen it, and it's hilarious.
I'm not funny redoing it, so I'll just link it in the show notes.
So, Pat?
Yes.
What's your favorite word?
My favorite word.
And remember, we are not an explicit show.
Okay, Chris, what's your favorite word? Okay,
Chris, go ahead.
Oh, that's diving even deeper.
You know, honestly, I'm sitting here trying to think of what I have as a favorite word. I know what word I really don't like. I don't think I have really a favorite word.
You have one word that you really, really don't like?
Yes.
Can you say it, or is it...
I can say that on the radio. It is loaf.
Really?
I just don't...
Loaf?
Yeah, loaf. L-O-A-F. I don't know, it's not,
As a verb, as a noun, or both?
Usually as a noun. Usually as a noun.
It's like, if you go to the grocery store, you buy a what of bread?
See, that's the unfortunate thing, is that I have to use it. Unfortunately, I don't know, it's just, in that particular context, I guess it's okay, but it still just doesn't sit well with me.
You go into the bathroom, you pinch off
that's when I don't like it.
We're at the root of it, yeah.
Maybe.
But the answer to your question would be baby arm.
Baby arm is
baby arm?
Word? Wow.
No, he pinches off a baby arm.
Oh.
You are a sick and twisted man, Chris.
Wow.
I love you. No, my favorite word is schadenfreude.
Really?
Are we going to count that as English? Because we're going to other languages.
You did not say what is your favorite word.
I haven't really looked up the absolute origins. Is moron or...
Well,
or
okay, fair enough.
Millennia, Latin not. Words?
And millennia would be more of a...
I don't know if they're
probably has a Latin...
Sure.
They all have some kind of
romantic languages.
Right, so... Okay, fair enough. We've adopted schadenfreude in English, so I'll give you that one.
It's even a whole song about it on Avenue Q.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I liked it before Avenue Q.
Well,
it's a good song in there, but I loved it when I first learned of schadenfreude.
If we're going to other languages, I would go with the German word schmetterling, which is the German word for butterfly, because it is so wrong. It sounds like the noise it makes when it hits your windshield.
The light and beautiful schmetterling.
Yeah, exactly. How can you see this beautiful little insect flapping around all orange and yellow and pretty and landing on flowers and think schmetterling?
Well, I find the same thing true of the word scud. Like, you know, you're like, where are the scud missiles? It's like, oh, man, that's a really nasty missile.
Yeah.
A scud missile.
Must mean to punch you in the face.
Right. And so I looked up the definition. What does scud mean? Is it an acronym for something, or is it a nasty word? No, it's how you describe a cloud. The cloud, I don't know if I'm using
it. It means to gracefully fly or float.
The cloud scudded across the sky something like that.
I thought you were talking about a particularly dirty type of porn, but that's just
no, that's scat.
Yeah, that'd be scat.
See, you didn't have to go there. It was implied in my... that's okay, guys.
I don't think the banter topic was home movies, Pat.
And you're... Oh, sass. Pat's scutological home movies. All right. So here's my...
Actually, Dan, I had one more thing.
Oh, okay.
So shut up, Dan.
If my calculations are correct, and since this is Fear the Boot and it's now online, they have to be correct.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, this is officially your 50th episode.
Is it really?
It is.
Man, I can never remember when I actually started. Wow.
I just wanted to congratulate you on 50 episodes.
Congratulations.
Hey, thank you very much.
That's like one for every year of your life.
I know. It's some sort of strange record. It's amazing. I don't feel 50. I feel like I barely started talking. And that's probably because Chad cuts me off most of the time.
That's right. Chad at feartheboot.com. What a jerk.
But let me tell you something.
He's talking.
You may think Chad is a jerk, but this man gives some of the best man hugs I've ever had in my entire life.
I love a good man hug.
You're very good at it. You're very
good
at it.
You're not the first person to tell me I'm a good hugger.
Really?
Yeah.
And a first man to tell you? Don doesn't count.
You want to know the nastiest thing I could possibly say? Dan's mother thinks I'm a good hugger. She has told me so.
Really?
I don't recall, so I'm not saying you're wrong. I just don't recall it.
Yeah. She says, wow, you're a good hugger.
That's possible.
Dan's mom got brought up 2 weeks in a row. Is this going to be a recurring theme?
She was brought up last week.
And he wasn't even here. Yeah. Cool.
So here's my question for you guys. This past Sunday, sitting at gaming, of course, we're gaming it's a homebrew-ish system. It's a combination of the Battlestar Galactica system, which has a name.
Cortex.
Okay. So it's a combination of Cortex with some elements of Spirit of the Century. So it's kind of a homebrew, but not exactly. But while we're sitting there before the game, Chad has picked up a copy of Mouse Guard.
Yes.
And he was sitting there flipping through it. And as he was flipping through it, I'm looking at the book, so I was sitting right next to him. And I come to notice that this book, it looks really good. It's a great product. So I have no idea how the gameplay is. We haven't tried it yet. We intend to play it.
Yeah, I'm only on like page 12. I haven't even started really reading it yet.
But just looking at the production value of the book looks really good. But one of the things that I quickly noticed was it uses a rather large font. There's a lot of double space stuff. There's massive margins. Mm-hmm. There's massive space between the columns on the page.
If they were a lot tighter, they could have made the entire book a quarter of its size.
Yeah, exactly. This is a book that I don't remember how long it was. It's 250 pages something like that. But if they had actually typeset this book the way a normal RPG book is set, it would have been a 40 or 50 page pamphlet. It would not have been this big, vast book like it is. So this sparks another conversation or a side thought, which I want to bring up on the air for the benefit of the listeners, but also to get Chris's take on it, since he obviously was not there for our Sunday game, which is this. As we've said in the past, Fear the Boot's an a-religious, apolitical show. And so I'm going to start telling you some things, but I'm not going where you think I may be with this. So just bear with me. But I took out two pocket Bibles. Now, these are full, unabridged Christian Bibles, Old Testament, New Testament, no books missing. This is the whole deal. And for anyone who's not lived under a rock for their entire life, I'm sure you know the Bible's a really long book. Mm-hmm. Now, I measured these two pocket Bibles. The first one was 4.5 inches wide, 6.5 inches tall, 3/4 of an inch thick. For you metric inclined people, that's 11 centimeters wide, 17 tall, 2 thick. I took the other one. This one was 3.25 inches wide, 7 tall, 0.75 thick. In metric, that's 8.5 centimeters wide, 18 centimeters tall, 2 centimeters thick. Now, both of these books, the second one in particular being only 3.25 inches wide, I could take and put in the pocket of a pair of jeans. The other one at 4.5 inches wide wouldn't quite fit in jean pockets, but like the cargo shorts I'm wearing right now, I could easily put that Bible into the cargo pockets of these shorts and carry it around with me. Now, here is my question. Certainly, I like having nice big role-playing books because they're easy to read. They have pretty art.
When you have a lot of them, it's an impressive gaming collection show.
And it's easier to find things quickly, doesn't strain your eyes. I'm not at all against full-sized regular role-playing game books. I'm not even bitching about Mouse Guard, which quite frankly probably has a lot of debatably wasted space. It's a beautiful product. But here's my question.
I think that, on a side note, I think that they made the large spaces in there to show off the art.
Which I don't doubt. Yeah. Like I said, it looks good. I'm not complaining about the product. But here's my question. It just got me thinking. Wouldn't it be cool if, and or would you buy, portable pocket copies of role-playing games? Let's say you have your D&D 3.0, 3.5, 4.0, 2.0, whatever you prefer, book, but you want to kind of game on the go, or maybe have it with you at a con just in case, or I don't even know what your motivation would be. Maybe you just hate lugging around great big stacks of books. Wouldn't it be cool if these companies offered pocket versions of their books? And if you can fit a Bible into the dimensions I just gave, you can fit the D&D Player's Handbook into the dimensions I just gave. Now, granted, it's going to be that tissue paper like a Bible's made out of. It's probably not going to have a lot of art. The charts are going to have to be somewhat simplified. It's going to be a simpler format, but nonetheless, it would be a lot more portable, a lot easier. You know, you'd like to stick in your pocket and go. I would love to have something like that.
What I find particularly interesting is this week I picked up what they call the pocket edition of Mutants and Masterminds. You're not going to fit that in anybody's pocket. The thing is the size of a trade paperback. It's still smaller than the hardback.
Right.
But they're calling it a pocket edition, but it's not going to actually fit in a pocket.
Savage Worlds Explorer's Editions is like that.
It's the exact same size as Explorer's Edition.
It's more convenient because it's smaller than a full-blown RPG book. But at the same time, like you said, this is still not something that I'm going to actually slip into the pockets of my pants and walk around with. I still have to give up a hand to carry this book.
The other advantage is, besides the size, is the price. As they get these smaller, they get cheaper and cheaper, and it's more of an introduction. I'd be willing to pick up two or three of the pocket size if they had them available. I picked up this, I would pick up Savage Worlds, things like that aren't actually down to the pocket size yet, because it's an introduction. If I get it, I look through it, I like it, I'll go out, I'll buy the hardback to have.
I think that's exactly why you're not going to see companies ever do this concept of making a pocket version in addition to their regular size, because when you put out a product, got your new edition of the game, you've gone to all the trouble to have the hardback, you know, the full size with all the art and everything like that. That's the product they're pushing and they're selling. They want to sell X number of, you know, they want to sell, you know, so many millions of these. If you've got the same product basically in a pocket version, obviously it's going to be cheaper. A good percentage of your players, that's one they're going to get because it's cheaper. It's smaller for all those reasons. So you're going to lose sales on the big book, which is what they want to sell because it looks pretty and everything like that. I think it is a great idea, Dan. And yes, I would love to have that. I would love to have that pocket version if it was truly a pocket version. But I don't think you're ever going to see it. And that's my opinion as to why.
Well, you know what Mutants and Masterminds did to get around that? They left out chapters. They left out everything for the GM as well as the character sheets. Mm-hmm. The idea is this pocket version that's much too large to actually be in a pocket. The whole point of that is that you can have it on your table. You can glance through the rules. The players can use it. But if you want to actually run a game on it, it's missing a few things. Well, see, you could run a game, but you don't have all the resources.
And that's kind of what I'm talking about is, you know, the example I gave with the two Bibles, that's the full thing. It's not dropping books. It's not like two Gospels and Psalms and Proverbs. I mean, it's the full thing. I would love to see this in its full version. I see a use to what you're describing, but what I'm asking for is the full thing.
Now, so, you had me. I was totally up with you. It's like, yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, it's good. Small books. In your pocket, on the go, that's great, not having to lug around backpacks and stuff, until you said the words, tissue paper pages. That totally lost me on the entire concept. They're too delicate, they're too easy to break, you spill one soda, the book is destroyed. And
that just means you have to buy another copy.
You want to know a secret? They've already done that. In fact, they did it a number of years ago with D&D.
First edition books, the little 4-inch by 3. Yeah, I remember when they were really cool.
They had, and this was during the 2E days, but somebody reprinted all the first edition, you know, the one with the blue background and the wizard on the cover and the DMG and all that. They printed those, and yeah, they're super tiny, and I think they might have even had a hole in them so you could attach them to your keychain if you wanted to. I'm not sure about that, but there have been, I mean, and that was done more as a novelty item.
Yeah. But they were large enough to be usable. I mean, you had to hold them like 2 inches from your eyeball to read them, but it was readable.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there was a game company, I want to say it was, might have been Plain Label, and they did something like that where their games were small, and they essentially put them in a jewel case, a CD jewel case, not the slimline ones because they didn't have those out at the time. But it was a standard CD-sized jewel case, so it was close, but you know, you have to have big pockets. They had all the rules in there, and you could put them in there.
So I used to work with a guy called Neil, and he was the lazy GM for a while when he was on our blog. And he has a story of going to Gen Con one year, and this was probably back when it was in Milwaukee. This is many, many moons ago. And he says he saw the fattest man he's ever seen in his whole life. This guy was pushing 500 pounds. I mean, it was morbid obese, right? Gigantic man. And Neil was riding up the escalator, and this guy gets on the escalator at the bottom. Neil's probably about halfway, and you know, he turns around, he doesn't want to, he's like, oh, that guy is huge. And he's kind of, you know, looking at him out of the corner of his eye, but trying not to be too rude. And he gets to the top of the escalator ride, and he kind of dallies just a little bit, you know, just long enough for the guy to catch up. And he dallies a little bit off to the side. And the guy gets to the top, literally waddles over about 6 feet puts his hand on a column and is going, he got winded from riding an escalator. He was so large. But then the guy reaches behind him, pulls out of his rear pants pocket an entire hardcover full-size D&D player's handbook.
And then suddenly he only weighed 100 pounds.
That's right. So, book size, pocket size, that's all relative.
So I was going to say, the moral to your story is, if we want pocket-sized books, we just all have to gain about 400 pounds.
The book sizes are fine. It's too small.
Well, maybe we need gamer pants for like the rear pants pocket. There's just one that stretches the width of your entire ass.
There you go.
So you have your whole gaming collection.
Instead of having words on our ass.
That's a brilliant idea, gamer pants. I mean, especially when it comes to con, you know, because, I mean, who else's back wasn't killing them by the time Gen Con was over with, you know, because it's a sea of cargo pants and backpacks. And to have just a regular pair of pants with huge ass pockets that you can slide an 8.5 by 11 book in, that's genius.
Even have pockets to where you, when you sit down, your dice don't all come spilling out.
That reminds me, first day of Gen Con, first full day, I think a Thursday, Chris and I are walking around and he's like, everybody's got cargo pants. No one was wearing cargo pants. Like, cargo pants ever? Cargo pants. And I start saying something about, oh, well, they're really useful and comfortable, especially gamers. We've got a lot of stuff. And I look down and he's wearing cargo pants.
I was wearing cargo pants.
And I'm looking, it's like, you're wearing cargo pants, you idiot. And he's like, I know, they're everywhere.
I don't think we're going to see a lot of pocket-sized game books. And I'm going to go for a slightly different reason than what Pat gave, which is this. The vast majority of these game companies, particularly the bigger ones, are not doing print-on-demand. You have to go out and get a guy to do the layout. You have to get someone to do all the typesetting and such to actually figure out how this book's going to come together.
Yeah, graphic designers.
Yeah, make sure it's legible. And then you're going to have to go out and print a lot of these. And by lot, I don't mean many. I mean as in like an ordered lot, like a pallet of these.
A case
of these, whatever. And then try and move these units right alongside your big books. And of course, if you also got onto the retail level, if you take a DMG, a regular DMG, most bookstores know how to shelve that.
Mm-hmm.
Pocket books seem to just waste shelf space given their height. And so I've got to think that for more business reasons than anything else, this is never going to catch on. But it's just something that I would love to have. And if they made these available, forget PDF, forget Kindle, forget all this other crap.
I would like to forget Kindle. That's a horrible device.
Well, different rant for different time.
Chad at feartheboot.com.
They only read PDFs or Kindle files, and nothing else on the face of the planet reads Kindle files. And they charge you $400 for this privilege.
It was an Amazon power play because they're so big they can do it. It's the same thing Disney does all the time, strong-arming with, copyright laws and playback formats and everything else under the sun.
I think that is an ebook reader a good thing or a bad thing? I think you can have a good discussion on that. I think Kindle's horrible.
But my point being that if these were out there, I would buy them, but I don't think they're ever going
to
be out there.
Even if the pocket editions don't come out, I'd like to see more of the smaller books, like the Savage Worlds Explorers Edition, the Mutants and Masterminds Pocket Edition, just something smaller because, you know, for a new player coming in, seeing all of these books, the huge expense to it, when you don't know if you're ever going to even run a game at that point.
Yeah.
You know, you're new to the hobby. You're not ready to run a game. You just want to look through some rules books. Having these cheap alternatives that are still the full rules right then and there, that's handy.
You know, Dan, I think one of the other factors that would probably contribute to smaller books not showing up, people are used to larger size books. You know, they're used to seeing that, they're used to having that, and they attach a certain value to that size of book, you know, and because they like the feel of it in their hands, they like carrying it around, they certainly like the way it looks on their shelves at home because it's all nice and uniform and looks kind of cool. So I think that there's a consumer demand for a continued thing of that type of book.
Oh, well, and certainly there's cool artwork and all kinds of other reasons to collect books of that size. I'm not advocating at all the abolition of large books.
There is definitely a market for both.
I say
you can take my large book from my cold, dead hands, Mr. Reppinger.
I'm just, you've known me since I was 3 and you can't get my last name right. But anyway, I'm just advocating.
Nobody can get your last name right.
No, it's just
no, Lord
Fowl
did. He got you your RPG-er. Wow, did that joke suck?
I would just like to see them available as an alternative, is what I'm saying. I would like to be able to have both. Because, I mean, Chad, you know me. I always have my pockets full of junk.
Apparently, I don't know you, sir. Okay,
apparently, yeah, true. All right. Pat, you know me. I mean, I've always got all kinds of stuff in my pockets.
So he speaks the truth.
We're in cargo shorts right now.
And so am I.
I say, if I could put...
It's like we're brothers.
I could have a DMG in one pocket, a player's handbook in the other, and be ready to go.
Yeah.
But I can't do that. That's just not an option. So instead, I have to have an NIV in one pocket and an NAS in the other, which won't help me around the game table.
Go with God.
But, yes.
You're one of those people. You always have a pin.
Oh, yes.
I never had...
Typically two or three.
And I never had to carry a pin around with me ever in the past 30 years because I know this man had a pin.
In fact, I have, what, two on me right now? Yeah, two on me right now.
I keep pins in my dice bag. One more thing that I stuff it with.
Nice.
It's kind of like a those little clown cars. You just never know what I'm going to pull out of the dice bag.
You stuff it with stuffing?
No stuffing yet.
Put a potato in there?
Yeah, that'd be pretty good.
I stuff it with zombies.
He does.
Let's talk one-shot games. I don't think I have to do a whole lot to set up the definition or parameters of this conversation, except I'll maybe grant you that a one-shot may go for two sessions long. But the point being, a game where you intend from the get-go for this to only go for a very, very, very short amount of time. You're not looking for a campaign that's going to last months, years, probably even weeks. This might be something where you're running a four-hour game at a con. This might be something where you've got some buddies coming in town and they're only going to be there one night. Or you've got somebody who wants to try an RPG but doesn't really want to commit, so you'll just do a four-hour session or whatever. There's many reasons you might run one. But I want to talk today about one-shot games. So I want to cover this from a few angles. First, why you might run one. I want to talk about some of the reasons that they're great and some of the opportunities they offer. And then I also want to talk about some of the problems that they can present. So doing a quick bit of thinking, I came up with several reasons that you might run a one-shot game. I listed most of them, but I'm going to add a few more items to that list. First off, this might be a concept that you know has no lasting traction. It's an idea where you know this would be neat for a few hours, but then it would quickly get boring. Comedy games, I think, are a big one like that. It is hard to keep a comedy game consistently going week to week. Not saying it can't be done, and more power to the people that can do it. I personally could not run a comedy game more than one session.
I actually have an example here, too. I've been considering a Clue game, basically creating a role-playing game based on the board game Clue. That would easily be a one-shot, but you could not make a campaign out of that. At least I couldn't.
Yeah, because once you solve the mystery,
exactly,
the game's over.
Could be a lot of fun, but there's no lasting playability there.
The other one that I didn't mention before is that you might have an idea that's so experimental or so out there that you know it's going in total chaos anyway. And so even if there would otherwise be the potential for a longer campaign, you can pretty much predict the inevitable implosion of your idea. And so you go with that. For example, I think competitive gaming would be a big one like this. If you are setting out from the start where everyone in the party is trying to stab each other in the back, and
eventually somebody has to get stabbed in the back.
Precisely, and it all goes down from there. Now, I know we differ in opinions both within the cast and outside of the cast on how well inter-party tension can or can't work within a game, which is a different topic. But you could have an idea that's so experimental or so weird that...
At least for your group.
Yeah. At least for your group, that you really don't know how people are going to respond to it.
You want to go from D&D dungeon crawls, like old school dungeon crawls, to Dogs in the Vineyard.
Or Don't Rest Your Head.
Yeah, you might want to consider that one-shot game before you do. So, Dan, have you ever been in a one-shot game? Purposeful plan one-shot game, not a campaign that failed on the first day, because I've had those two.
Yeah, I've been in more of the latter than the former. To answer your question on the former, yes. First of all, con gaming, of course, comes to mind. Cons are probably the single biggest example of one-shot games, because in all probability, you're running it with a group of strangers, or at least mostly strangers, who you're not going to see again for a long time, may never see again at all, and so you have no choice but to run a one-shot game. There's also, Chad, we used to have a game, a comedy game that was a homebrew called Life.
Yes.
That we used to run internally. And it was with the intention. We knew the game was going to descend into just total absurdity within very short order.
The entire concept was usually it's modern day, took place in high school because we were high school kids at the time, and everything was completely realistic. Now you can do whatever you wanted to. If you had a zany idea, like a really crazy zany idea, it worked. You wanted to be a normal high school student, but you knew kung fu and shoot lasers out of your eyes, you can do it. No plot, just go and create mayhem.
I have two examples of times I think would be good for one-shot games. After you've gone through a long campaign before you're ready to start another one, and you just need a short fluff session.
You need a palate cleanser?
Right after a long campaign, you've really got into this. Now you need something short time, you know, just a quick game. Get ready for the next session.
Well, doubly so if the GM needs more time to prepare, or you have one main GM that runs all the time. That might give them a break from writing and running the game and allow somebody else to step up. And they wouldn't feel a lot of pressure because it's only going to be one shot anyway.
That's actually another thing. If a GM's nervous about running a game, they'd be a lot more willing to run for just a short period. That's why the pass the GM type games are right. So good for new people.
I got some reasons of my own on why one-shots are good. But Chris, I want to hear real quick because I understand that you are not in favor of one-shot games.
I'm not a huge fan. I mean, I do enjoy them and they have their purpose. And con gaming, definitely. Con games, I have absolutely no problems because that's really what you're there for. But in an ongoing setting where, you know, when you get together for your weekly game or your bi-weekly game, that's kind of where I have a real problem with them. For me, I like to build a story, and I like to build some, you know, continuity with what we've got there. And to do a one-shot, to me, it's like, I don't know, you ever heard of the term sister kisser? It's where you can kiss your sister, it's great and all, but it doesn't get you anywhere.
What?
Wow. You never heard that term before?
Am I not getting this because I'm an only child, or freaky?
No, it's a sport term. They use it to describe like tie games. You know, it's a sister kisser. Yeah, you had fun, but you really didn't do anything good.
Is there like an incest bowl that falls somewhere between like the cotton bowl and orange?
No, no. See, this is wow. We're not jocks. We don't get this.
Okay,
that's what it all boils down to.
I don't have a sister and I'm not a jock. I'm completely lost. Wow. People sound freaks.
Chris and his crimson pumpkin again.
Crimson pumpkin? Where the hell's that coming from? What's that?
Halloween, this past year, and I'll assume they'll do it again this year, a whole bunch of states required people that were sex offenders to put a picture of a crimson pumpkin on their front door so little kids would know not to go to those houses.
Oh, that's creepy and smart at the same time.
Yeah, there was a big to-do over, I'm not going to get into it because it's a political show, but there was a big to-do over several sides of that debate and blah, 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 and I don't really care to get it. I was just making fun of you.
Okay.
So, sorry, but Chris, you were saying.
Please continue. All
right. I will. Well, let me agree with you. The incest aside, let me agree with you. The problem I have doing one shots a lot of the time, and I think this is why I don't do more of them, and I'm going to extol their virtues here in a second. But before I back up to that, the problem that I personally have, just me, Dan, internally, is that I think I have an overambitious mind. And I don't mean that as a praise to myself. Like, sometimes a problematically overambitious mind. Ask Carla, we're constantly throwing away food I didn't eat.
Your long list of failed hobbies.
Yes, as you said, my hobby is collecting hobbies, precisely. And so when I sit down to dream up a game, or I'm sitting there doing whatever, and just the idea for a campaign comes to me, it's never short. It's always this big, involved story with twists and a major climax, an anti-climax, and then a second climax.
There's a lot of climaxes.
There's a lot of climaxes. Yeah. Once again,
it's fantastic.
It's about 15 sessions in between each climax.
And so,
yeah, and you know what?
In those 15 when Dan sessions, talks about, you do a lot of just kind of laying around and smoking.
When Dan talks about climax, I can only think of a very short game with him anyway, but
the point
that would be a one shot.
It would be a one shot.
What comes to my mind, kind of like Chris, is never a short game. It's always, I want to see where I can go with this. I want to try and explore these ideas. I want to draw this out. I want to really build up to a big finish or to completely change the world. Do things you just plain can't accomplish in a one-shotter.
That's kind of where I'm at with those two. It's that, yes, it's fun on the surface, but I like to be able to have something to hang on to. And, you know, a perfect example, I decided before Gen Con, I had one last gaming session with my son and his friends, And I didn't really have any time to prepare anything for the D&D side of things. So I'm like, you know what? Let's just play BattleTech. We'll do a one shot. So we ran them through there. I it was a quick scenario. They had a good time. But I found myself, even while going through that one shot, and after it was over, describing to them what they could do from this point forward with the ones that survived. And I even started to try and imprint some sort of, you know, story upon what they're doing besides just moving counters and miniatures across the battlefield. You know, because I need that, like you, I want to have something more there. So it's hard for me to really wrap my head around one-shots on any sort of consistent basis.
But Chris, so, don't you run and play in con games? And don't you run very, and I've heard that you run very, very good con games.
But see,
too.
That's where the mindset, though, is different, because I'm not at home. This is not a weekly game. I'm going there with the intention of sitting around with these people who I'm probably not going to see until the next con, and doing this thing for one thing. And then internally, I'm okay with that.
But to me, a con game is the epitome of a one-shot.
It absolutely is. That's why I said at the beginning, I don't have any problem with one-shots in a con setting. In fact, I enjoy them. You know, I've had some of my most enjoyable gaming times ever at cons with those one-shot things, just because of their unique nature. It's very, very different in a con setting than it is a one-shot at home. It's just completely different.
I'm on the same page with you, Chris, and the fact, like what you're saying is, it's that whole mindset of a one-shot really is not really something that you want to do with your core gaming group, like your home gaming group. Like you wouldn't want to go week to week just doing a different one-shot, or say, you know, every few weeks or something.
So along like those,
it's a different mindset.
It sounds like it's an issue in expectation setting, where I go in to watch a TV show. I understand it's going to be over in 30 or 60 minutes. If I went out to see a movie and it was over in 30 or 60 minutes, I'd be pissed.
Sure.
And yeah. I know some of that's the economy of the money involved. But let's say even money wasn't involved. It was just a free rental or something.
Yeah. No, you still have an expectation going into it.
Yeah. And see, I follow what Chris is saying. I understand how he can have that mental divide. I don't know if I want to call it cognitive dissonance, but you can have that mental separation of wanting a campaign out of your normal game while the same things that would bother you around your weekly gaming table wouldn't bother you at a con. I follow.
Well, and a one-shotter seems to me to be very situational. Like you said, Pat, you wouldn't want to do a one-shot one week and then another one-shot another week and then another one-shot another week. No, I wouldn't want to do that either. And they're all disconnected and stuff. I certainly wouldn't want that.
Speaking of situational, have any of you ever used a one-shot as a way to demo the hobby? Chad and I, for example, we've had multiple people come to us recently and say, I've been hearing you guys talk all about this. I want to know what this is like. Can I come and watch your game? And our answer, of course, is no. No, you can't. You can't stand over our shoulders and make us nervous.
Filthy voyeurs.
So a one-shot might be a perfect chance to actually sit these people down. They all have an interest, and just show them this is what it actually is about.
I have not yet, but I see it coming, and here's why. Given the number of people apparently you know that would like to try it without the deep commitment, and given the fact that my own brother-in-law, Adam, would like to try it without making us make a commitment.
Something
I don't know
tells
that
me
can.
We need to get all these groups together and have, then get them to leave us alone.
Well, even that aside, Chad, you were talking about, for example, wanting to try to do a really short game or a one-shot with something like Mouse Guard, or you had written, or you were coming up with some ideas based on the Fables comic.
Yeah.
And this Fables seems like funny. A perfect opportunity to get these guys you know from work, for me to get my brother-in-law, sit these people down with the understanding it's a one-shot, like you just said, Wayne, simply to show them the hobby, and we're not having to do the preparation it would take to run a campaign for
actually,
people
I'm just
that may
trying
hate
to,
it.
I'm just trying to convince all these people to come to Fear the Con 3.
Honestly, that's an even simpler idea.
And play con games with
bring them to a con. I mean, they'll drink more than $15 or $20 or whatever we charge this year in beer and soda anyway. Well, so they'll get their money's worth.
Yeah, and I mean, besides the cheap shill for the con, I am serious about it in another respect, because we have people who run games for newbies. We have a very friendly community. Most role-playing game communities are very friendly, so if you can't get these strangers who don't listen to the show or play role-playing games but are curious, you know, there's local cons in your area. Get them to go to one of those. But
let me take a moment here to extol some of the virtues I came up with for one-shot games. Since we've expressed a lot of trepidation, let me talk about the other side of the coin. came up with some things I think are great about it. First of all, there's less preparation. Because of the fact that all you really have to do is come up with enough setup to get the ball rolling and then a few contingencies for where it might go in the course of just a couple hours, there's a whole lot less preparation. You don't need gobs of NPCs. You don't need to figure out all these long-term plot ramifications of what if they kill the king in the first scene. There's a lot of things in here where you as a game master can get away with some shortcuts.
If I can expand on that, Dan, also, you don't have to worry about a character advancement or some of the other details you'd have to get into for a longer campaign. It can simplify things.
Well, kind of related to that, even on the player side, in addition to not have to worry about advancement, the players have the opportunity to try out characters they might not otherwise try. For example, you always play the sneaky thief, and this time I want you to try and play the charismatic politician or something. I don't know, I guess maybe they're the same thing. But I want you to play something completely different, or you want to try something strange, or maybe you want to try a rules mechanic like, gee, would it really be possible to have this kind of alien in the party or it would just be too powerful? There's opportunities here for the players to experiment with the characters that they're playing. And in the same way, the game master can experiment with the rules, can experiment with the setting, because of the fact that if you botch something, it's not like you've just wrecked something you've spent weeks building and intended to run for months or years. All you did was mess up one night. Oh, well, everything implodes. You grab a few beers and go hit the Wii. Who cares? In addition to being experimental, there's less concern over how it all ends. I think because people come into it with a different set of expectations, people are going to be less emotionally charged about it. That if it doesn't quite go the direction they wanted, if it's a little bit boring, if it's a little too tense, if just for some reason it doesn't fit their taste, they're not going to be so upset about that. And you also might convince them to try games they wouldn't otherwise try. You got the guy who's only ever played D&D, and you're trying to convince Dave to try out Star Trek. A one-shot game might be the perfect way to get them to do that, because they can feel like they're walking into it, not really committing, I think I'm going to hate XYZ. But if you say, look, dude, it's just for one afternoon, probably somebody's going to be a lot more open to saying, okay, I'll give it a try.
I think on a weekly game, that may be the case. But I think at a con, people may actually have a little bit higher expectations of some of these games. Because going in, it seems like every game is designed to be, this is the big bang. It's not a not a short thing. So people are coming in trying to balance their time at the con. At this slot, I have to pick between these games. So if I'm giving up this game that I want to play this one, I really hope it's good or I'll be disappointed.
That's an interesting thing about con gaming that's different from your weekly game. Yeah, it's all one-shots, but it's all the climax. Every single game you play in is the big push. It's high intensity gaming.
If every game is epic, is any game epic?
One shots also invoke a different playing style with players, because the emotional investment in the character that you may be playing is, you know, at most 4 hours, and that's near the end of the session. So players get a different, just kind of get a different mental attitude about themselves and about what they want to do with the characters, because really, if he dies, I ain't going to play him again, so who cares? So they're bound to take a few more risks, do a few more outlandish things, and play a bit more dangerously with things and be a little less conservative, basically, with their character that they're playing.
But isn't that a good thing in a four-hour game?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It is a good thing in a four-hour game when it is just a four-hour game. You know, obviously you can run into some problems if it's an ongoing thing. But sure. It also, you know, there is the other benefit to it is, particularly with, you know, in the con setting, or even in a home setting, you have an opportunity to have a certain degree of more fun, because you can do some outrageous things without really having to worry about what the consequences might end up being. And that's okay. You know, and it helps to kind of, you know, stretch those muscles, those role-playing muscles, which don't get used maybe very often, because you don't want your dude to die.
At a con game, if you do something that you would be embarrassed by later, chances are you'll never see those people again.
Yeah, and I think just, you know, for the very reasons that you sort of stated, Chris, I think that this sounds like a really good idea for new players, just for the reasoning of letting them sort of cut loose, sort of bringing them out of their shell, so to speak. I mean, I think a lot of newer players, and Wayne, I think you've spoken to this a little bit, is, you know, you come in with all these things and worrying about, oh, am I going to make a mistake, or, you know, how's this going to happen, or how's this going to work? And if you have this situation where really the pressure's off, like you're saying, you can sort of cut loose and have fun and everything goes to hell in a handbasket, who cares? That could be a really good tool, a really good thing for new players.
Yeah, that actually leads, though, into one of the pitfalls or considerations, special considerations, I'll call them, that I came up with for running a one-shotter. And one of them is, when you're not that deeply invested in the game, it gives you a sense of liberation or freedom to experiment. But that
gives you a liberation to experiment.
It can swing too far the other direction to where you are so uninvested that you're not taking the game seriously. You're trying something so outlandish, it's not going to work from the start.
The game itself is so experimental and so weird. Like, maybe you didn't buy a game, but you're coming up with something and you're just going way off in the left
field. Even, you know, and I noticed this in a con game, it's a little different because, like I think it was Chris said, you come in wanting that big bang. And so even though it's only going to be 4 hours long, I can see people really thinking about investing in their characters. But if I did this with my weekly gaming group, I would be concerned running a one-shot game that basically nobody there would really think about their characters because they're not looking for the big bang. It's like, well, this is just a blow-off game between two major campaigns. And so there'd be so little investment there that the game would be somewhat subconsciously sabotaged from the get-go.
Yeah, you know, I'm not saying you're wrong. You're absolutely right. That to me, that's really disappointing because, for one, I am going to run a small one or two shot game after our main campaign is done as an in-betweener game, a palate cleanser, so to speak. And also we're doing Mouse Guard and I kind of want to introduce the guys to the indie scene a little bit and such. And if I was a game master and that happened, that would be incredibly disappointing to me because the players have to give something back. I mean, to make a game interesting.
Well, you know, something else, and I'm not saying you should do this, but something you can get away with also in a one-shot game, you obviously have to do this at a con, but you can do it in your weekly gaming group, is if you want to really try and push somebody out of a shell or out of a rut, you walk in and say, look, it's a one-shotter. Here's the characters everybody's playing.
Yeah.
Here's the character sheet, and here's two paragraphs explaining his background and personality. And you as a game master can force somebody to try something they wouldn't have otherwise tried.
And people
might accept that because it's a one-shot.
I've already thinking of making everybody's characters for them simply because I have an idea for a character of a mouse that has a pet bumblebee. Huh. Because in Mouse Guard, they have certain insects that they keep as, quote, livestock. And I just imagine this guy or this mouse with a bee on his arm and a sensor with smoke in the other hand. And if anybody messes with him, he just pushes the smoke away and throws the bee at him.
Chad and I actually had this question on the way over, though, is for one-shot games, do you think it's better to provide the characters or to let people create them? For a con game, obviously, you know going in that it's
you don't know
the people.
Yeah. Unless
the weekly game. And again, you said a one-shot game could actually be a couple weeks.
Yeah, I think it depends on the attitude. I'd go with the attitude of the players.
Yeah.
If the attitude of the players is that they're willing or looking to experiment or try something new, or you're trying to sell them on an idea, and they're willing to at least concede, it sounds crappy, but I might like it if I could play this, then I would try and give them that opportunity.
I think having them create their own character actually might deal with the issue you're discussing.
I think
they're more likely to get into that character if they had a hand in creating
it. Well, I think it's a mechanics question, too. If the system is something where character creation takes 4 or 5 hours, you're no longer talking about a one-shot game. You're at least talking about a two-shot game at the minimum.
Yeah. Right.
But I think that if you're going the other end of the spectrum in some of these indie games or rules-like game, then character creation could take all 5 minutes.
Or heck, we played for a couple weeks, and it could have been a one-shotter. It actually lasted a couple weeks, but we played a game. It was kind of like Iron Kingdoms, but we were using the stats from War Machine.
Mm-hmm.
And so pretty much it's like all you had to do is walk in and say, this is the concept of the character I'm playing. And then they would doodle up for you real quick. Stats based on War Machine. Character creation took all of like 10 minutes and you were good to go. And we could play around with concepts but it depends on the attitude of the players. Like I was saying, because I think we were willing to experiment a little more. We wanted to try some strange things we don't normally play, as opposed to the game master trying to push us out of a rut. And maybe you can get away with that politically on a one-shotter because nobody's deeply invested in it anyway.
What about a hybrid? You give them all of their stats, they come up with their backstory.
You just touched on something that I've been wanting to jump in here and say something about. For
Shut
me,
up, Pat.
A one-shot game, you're talking about one night, 4 or 5 hours, and you just hit the nail on the head right there. In a one-shot game, I don't want to invest that much in a character, coming up with a background, coming up with a story. What did he do as a kid? Why is he doing what he's doing now? I'm here to play the game. It's going to be one night, and we're going to be done with it. I'm not just saying that I'm just playing fighter guy, and we're going to do it. But what I'm saying is that you're talking about a campaign setting to me. That, what you just said, is my character in a campaign. I am invested. He has a story. That's what I'm there for. And then if I don't play this character again, I ran into this a lot when I first started playing. My group, we would do this. We would play some games and they would only last for a few sessions, but I would have spent a week or whatever in character creation, coming up with this good idea for a character and coming up with the name, which for me is a huge thing. And then we play it like twice and we're done. I'm like, God damn it.
See,
now we're done with it. So
you can always reuse
personally
that name.
My feeling on it would be I like the pre-gen characters, so that way you've got sort of right. You've got this group of characters here. I'll take this guy. I'll look over him for 5 or 10 minutes. I've got a concept for him in my head, and then we'll run with it.
Well, if you're the con this year, you should really try and play Dread. And the reason I say that is that in Dread, the character concept is already made for you, and mm-hmm. then you're handed a questionnaire that asks you questions about your character concept.
Uh-huh.
Questions that you don't have the answer to.
Sure.
Like, the example is, I think I was told my character was a tennis coach, basically, mm-hmm. or a personal tennis trainer. And one of the questions on there is, why does your character hate his job? Oh, no, I wasn't even given his job. It was just the question of, why does your character hate his job? I don't know what my character's job is. I don't know why he would hate it, but you have to answer it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, this, and this, and you think it up. And then that leads to the next question, the next question, the next question. Mm-hmm. And in 5 minutes, you have no mechanics. You have no dexterity. You have no fighting skill. You have no negotiate skill. No, none of that evil bluff skill I hate so much. But you have a fully fleshed out character
uh-huh.
that you can play, and you didn't. I totally get what you're saying of doing the mental exercise of coming up with that long campaign character where you're writing down a page, or even some people go page after page sure. of character background, and you're really putting a lot.
Well,
on
that's
it.
A waste on a one shotter because none of it's not going to come out anyway.
I agree.
I mean, if as a game master or a player, mm-hmm. if it's for a one shot game and you have more than a couple sentences of personality and a couple sentences of background, you're a dumbass because none of it's going to come out anyway.
Yeah, it's
your character's not going to radically change, maybe in more than one or two regards. I mean, it's a 4-hour game.
Yeah. That's the cool thing about Dread is that when the Game Master collects these 2-page questionnaires, he goes through them real quick, and maybe not every single thing that you wrote down is going to come up in the game because there's no way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the stuff that you play and you put out there, and he's fishing through the questionnaires for hooks. And then, it makes mental notes and stuff. It's like, okay, I can hook him with this. I can hook him with this. I can hook him with this. And then boom, boom, boom. And it's, you have a deep character that's interesting, that's fun to role play, that you have thought up, that you have made, that has plot hooks in the game for a one-shotter that you didn't spend 5 hours making and rolling up. You didn't spend tons and tons of pages writing histories and lineages and family trees on. And it's like this great balance. I've only played it once. I would love to play it again. I cannot wait for Fear of the Con 3 to come around because I really want to play this game again. I love this concept in Dread so much.
I think it might depend on the person too, because if you give someone a backstory, they can still make that character theirs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, Dan's Transformer game at Fear of the Con 2. Every character had you basically the motivations. And I know from talking to him that everyone approached the characters in completely different ways. Like when I came in, I took my character, I read my motivations, and what I took that to be was different from the person mm-hmm. who did it in the next game. And I took that and I ran with it. And it was everything that was on the paper, but it was still what I was wanting to get out of the character.
Yeah. And there's games, too, that are designed for the short game. Like, I've only, like, scratched the surface of playing it the mechanics-wise, but Spirit of the Century, it's my understanding it's a game that's made for one or two or three shot, very short campaigns that have a lot of pop and a lot of climax to them. And the major part of the character creation is simply coming up with your characters, coming up with the plot hooks of your characters and the motivations and the personalities and stuff. And then that translates into mechanic. So while you're writing the history of your character, that is also creating the mechanics for your character to play.
The last concern that I came up with regarding a one-shot game is that there's absolutely no time to correct problems. You have to get it right the first time. If you're sitting down for a
campaign... No pressure.
Yeah, in a way, you know, honestly, this is, I think, probably the scariest thing about a one-shot game. If I go into a con and I'm running a one-shot game, of course, I want people to walk away with a positive impression of my GMing ability, and I want people to have fun.
They only traveled thousands of miles to come to this con and pay the money just to sit in your game.
And so the con's even worse than worse than a regular week. Like you said, a regular week, you're at your house, you can say, let's go play Wii. You're at a con and you blow the game. They have nothing to do for the next 2 hours.
I'll bring my Wii to the con. That way, if you blow your game, Dan will say, hey, time for Wii.
But and then you take your pants off and then we
not what you meant by Wii?
No.
Are you going to bring your Nintendo video game system with you
bad.
Too?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Pat, your Wii won't last us 2 hours.
No, it won't.
But even with your weekly gaming group, if you have something go wrong during a big campaign, you can say, okay, let's retcon an event, let's adjust so-and-so's character, let's have that post-game conversation we talk about all the time, figure out what's going right, what's going wrong, and adjust it for next week. And everyone can say, okay, this one game session sucked, or this rule mechanic didn't work, but we've got a different approach for next game, and they come in a sort of a refreshed attitude. But with a one-shotter, you have one time at bat. You've got one strike, and you either get it right, or you don't. And fortunately, if you're within your own group, as you guys said, perhaps there's the expectation there that they game with you from week to week. They know overall, you know, the gestalt of their gaming experience has been positive. So this one little miss is not a big crisis. Whereas at a con game, you know, people are going to walk away saying, man, maybe so-and-so's not such a good GM. And I
think part of it is also incumbent upon the players. It's a short game. It's one shot. You can't just have the down game where you just don't feel like role-playing that night. You've got to bring it. You've got to allow the game master to kind of do a little bit hand-waving to make sure the plot's going on. You can't do the bookstores. You can't just kind of spin your wheels and I'm going to investigate this. You have to go for it. You have to keep, because it's part of your job as a player to keep that game moving.
There's something else that both the players and the GM have to do together, not just in executing the game, but in the case of the game master and preparing the game, which is get it moving quickly. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest mistake I made in the Transformers game that I ran through the con 2 was the startup, the introduction of the characters took too long. Mm-hmm. Now, truth be told, it didn't take that long. But in a 3.5 hour con game, it took too long.
Yeah.
In a campaign, it would have been fine. It would be a distant memory 3 games in. But in the course of a con game, or a one-shot, the same thing would apply if I was playing with my weekly group. You have to start that thing moving quickly. It doesn't just have to end with a bang. It has to start with a bang. And that's hard to do because of the fact you have no group template because you didn't have really the time to sit down with everyone and work one out. You might have one internally, the GM in his head, but the group as a whole doesn't have one. The players are probably unfamiliar with their characters. They're not into the groove of role-playing the characters. They haven't kind of found that
maybe the click. Mechanic of whatever you're doing is also completely foreign.
Precisely.
To them.
So maybe
they're not comfortable with each other.
They're not comfortable with the game system, any number of things. And so there's this real awkwardness where you have to bring your A game, not just at the climax of the plot, but at the introduction of the plot, because you've got to get these people in. I mean, they say that with albums and concerts that you always play your second best song first and your best song last, because of the fact that the lasting impression people have of a musical experience is how it started and how it ended. They'll usually kind of forget everything in the middle, but they will remember, did you get their attention? And did you leave them wanting more?
So, Dan, what would you do if you were running one of these one-shots and the group ends up either bickering with each other or, you know, completely in character, going down the wrong path?
Dan has a rolled-up newspaper he uses.
How do you get them back on track since you've got such a short time frame? So, you've mentioned the library thing. Let's say you're at a con game or a one-shot, and your group goes off to search the library, and the plot's not in the library. Does the plot just magically move to the library? Or
yeah,
do you have
there's nothing you can do. I mean, because in a one-shotter, I mean, maybe you can kind of nudge people and say, you know, get back over this way.
Do you think that it's okay to, in the middle of a one-shotter, to say, to kind of stop and say, guys, you're in the den, I need you to be in the library.
Absolutely.
I don't care how you do it, just library.
Yeah, I would say so, without a doubt. It's all due to time. And you don't even have to use those blatant of a words, you know. You can just drop the heavy-handed hints like, there's nothing to be found here. You find nothing. In fact, you're wondering why you're even here. You know, you drop those huge clues, and then you don't break that fourth...
You're wondering why you're even here.
You don't break that fourth wall, but you basically put the big clue in the center of the table, and they're like, oh, you know, maybe we should go to the library.
I'm just thinking about some of the campaigns and stuff that I've run. If I would have looked at my players like, you're wondering why you're even here, and they'd look back at me, no, I'm not. I'm here for this reason, and this reason. You're like, no!
No, really, you're not. You're starting to even question that.
I'm going to agree with Chris because, look, you've got one time at bat, and so you have to make that adjustment. Now, I would try to do it without being quite so overt.
Yeah.
For example, well, I can't even say I would do it without being so overt. I would actually more try to do it in preparation, try to see where this is going to go wrong.
Pass a note to one player that you trust. And it just says, go to the effing library.
Or don't, or get out of the effing library, one of the two. Library. But I'd also kind of look at it in preparation and say, look, I've got to make sure the shiny's right in front of them. Mm-hmm. Because I think people know, regardless of the setting, that being a short game, there's going to have to be a short and obvious plot. And so they're probably not going to get caught up exploring some weird tangent unless you as a game master made it sound important.
Yeah.
And if you made it sound important, that was your fault in either writing or executing the game.
You put Chekhov's gun in the library.
Yeah, exactly. And so you have to be careful both in writing and executing the game that you don't put too much spotlight on something that's irrelevant, because they're going to be looking for that glittering trail leading to the plot because they know you've only got 3 hours to get it in front of them.
And I think that you can use the good old tried and true game master hand waving stuff of, the plot was going to take place in the kitchen. They're not getting out of the library. Suddenly it happens in the library.
You're in the library. You open a book. The book has a note. It says, go across the street.
We have a few side little thoughts, actually, on one shot, so we didn't get to in this episode, which we'll follow up on probably somewhere in the next episode.
So this is just kind of like a one shot about one shots, but really it's going to be kind of almost like a campaign about one shots in a certain way.
Yes, and sure. We're going to get it all in your hair, Chris. If
you want to overthink it that way, that's fine with me. So, as for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you in the hair next time.
Fantastic!
Later days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.
I would have beaten that hussy if it weren't for those meddling voters.